In this video, I want to address the issue of the infallibility of the Church's laws and related matters. This video will cover important facts and quotes that you probably haven't heard before. This issue is particularly relevant because many people who believe that salvation can occur without the sacrament of baptism think they have proof for their position in the 1917 Code of Canon Law. They are quite wrong, as we will show in detail in this video. First, note that once again we are directly addressing the, quote, best arguments the other side tries to bring forward. The other side, however, typically ignores all or most of the arguments that refute their position because they don't have a cogent response to them. They also ignore the many contradictions in their claims and in the fallible sources they like to cite. Since proponents of, quote, baptism of desire constantly repeat their objections and talking points, while they ignore the counter-arguments, sometimes people get an imbalanced impression as if there's lots of magisterial support for baptism of desire. The truth is that they don't have any proof for their position. They do have many non-magisterial and fallible sources they can cite, but no magisterial proof. That's also why basically none of the priests who support that position will have a debate. Their arguments would not hold up. Our position is compatible with all of the data, whereas theirs is not. That's why we can address and refute their, quote, top objections in detail, as this video will show. The laws of the Catholic Church, that is of the entire Church, are spotless. The Church teaches and we affirm that the Catholic Church is spotless in her sacred laws imposed upon all. That was taught by Pope Pius XII in Mystici Corporis and by other popes. Notice the clause, imposed upon all. We affirm that the discipline of the Catholic Church, that is of the entire Church, is spotless. Indeed, in so many cases when people quote popes who have affirmed this teaching about the infallibility of the Church's laws or discipline, for example Gregory XVI, Pius VI, and Pius XII, they first saw those quotes in our material. I mention that because it's ironic that some of those very same people try to cite those popes against our position when they are misapplying them, as we will see. Delayed versus immediate ensoulment. Now, to understand whether this principle applies to something like the 1917 Code and to past collections of canon law, it's very instructive to begin with the issue of delayed ensoulment. It's quite relevant. That's the idea that the human soul is not infused into the embryo at the first moment of conception, but rather that it's only infused by God about 40 or 80 days after conception, when the embryo or fetus was considered to be formed. According to that view, which is called delayed ensoulment, the embryo would begin with a vegetative soul, then have an animal or sensitive soul, and then at some point, approximately 40 or 80 days after conception, God would infuse a rational or human soul. According to that view, only after 40 or 80 days, when the fetus was considered to be formed, did it become a human being. That position was held by St. Thomas Aquinas, countless scholastic theologians and philosophers, St. Robert Bellarmine, St. Alphonsus, various popes of the period, and more. It was also taught in the Catechism of the Council of Trent, quote, since, when the order of nature is observed, no body can be informed by a human soul except within the prescribed space of time, end quote. As we can see, the Catechism of Trent teaches delayed ensoulment, except in the case of Jesus, whom it considered to be an exception in that regard. Indeed, the authors of this part of the Catechism are so convinced that delayed ensoulment is true that they consider the exception to it in the case of our Lord to be an unprecedented wonder of the Holy Spirit. Their statement that no body can be informed by a human soul except within the prescribed space of time refers to the space or period of time when the fetus was considered formed, that is about 40 or 80 days after conception. This passage teaches that ensoulment before that prescribed space of time, that is, in approximately the first 40 or 80 days of the embryo's existence, is ruled out, except in the miraculous case of our Lord, and it also teaches that our Lord, being an exception to this, had a body that began as a fully formed fetus, not as what was considered to be an unformed embryo, lacking a rational or human soul. Hence, the Catechism clearly taught delayed ensoulment. St. Alphonsus also taught that delayed ensoulment was certain and held by all. Here are some passages from his book, Moral Theology. Quote, but rightly does Turnley's Continuatio observe that there should not be baptized a fleshy lump that has no arrangement of organs, since it is universally accepted that the soul is not infused into the body until the latter is formed, and then, in order for it to be baptized, it is required that it exhibit some vital movement, as the Roman ritual prescribes. End quote. Before I cite more from St. Alphonsus, consider a few things. St. Alphonsus says that it's universally accepted that the soul is not infused into the body until the latter is formed, in other words, delayed ensoulment. This was also presupposed in the Roman ritual, which was formally promulgated by Pope Paul V in 1614. The Roman ritual prescribed the rites and ceremonies that priests use in administering sacraments. Those who put together the Roman ritual believed in delayed ensoulment. They did not believe that the embryo or fetus had a human soul until it was considered formed. Consequently, in cases of abortion or miscarriages which resulted in severely deformed embryos or fetuses, which were called monstra or monsters, the official prescription of the Roman ritual promulgated by Pope Paul V was that those monstra, that is monsters, were not to be baptized if they resembled a beast. It stated, quote, "A monster that fails to exhibit a human appearance ought not to be baptized. But if there is any doubt about this, let it be baptized under the following condition, if you are human." End quote. St. Alphonsus also comments on this matter in his Moral Theology. He states, quote, "A monster that reflects the form of a human in its head and chest should be baptized, but not if it resembles a beast." End quote. Notice, if they thought the deformed embryo or fetus resembled an animal, they taught that it was not to be baptized. Again, this was connected to their view of delayed ensoulment, which held that before the embryo or fetus was considered formed, it did not have a rational soul, and therefore was not considered to be a human who could receive baptism, but rather an animal. St. Alphonsus continues, quote, "But if in fact only the head is ferine, that is, of a wild beast, Comitolus thinks that it should be baptized. However, Navarrus and others want this to be put off until there is a clearer understanding of the matter, unless there is an imminent danger of death, in which case it should be baptized conditionally. When there is any doubt whether the monster is human, it should absolutely be baptized if the head is human, even though the body parts are ferine, that is, of a wild beast. But only conditionally should it be baptized if the head is ferine and the body parts human. But this is only the case if it proceed from the intercourse of a man with a woman. For if it issue from that of a man with a beast, which I think incredible, then it should always be baptized conditionally. Otherwise, if it issue from that of a woman and a brute beast, then in no way should it be baptized, for then it would not descend from Adam, inasmuch as it was not conceived from male semen." End quote. Here we see that the widely accepted view of delayed ensoulment was intimately connected to official prescriptions for priests on the matter of whether to baptize certain people. Indeed, various popes and papal bulls even make a distinction between fetuses animated and not animated. That manifests that those popes believed in delayed ensoulment, which was widespread at the time. Here's an example from Pope Gregory XIV's May 31, 1591 papal bull. Quote, "Since a little while ago our predecessor of happy memory, Sixtus V, inflamed by zeal for justice, published a constitution against those procuring the abortion of a fetus, whether animated or not animated, and those who are participants or helpers of that most grave crime." End quote. The reference to fetuses, whether animated or not animated, expresses his belief in delayed animation or ensoulment. In his 1588 bull Ephraenatam, Pope Sixtus V makes a similar reference to animated and not animated fetuses. He even adds the words, whether formed or unformed. Do those references in papal bulls to fetuses animated and not animated prove that delayed ensoulment is true, certain, and the infallible teaching of the Catholic Church? While it proves that those popes believed in delayed ensoulment, it does not prove that it's true or the infallible teaching of the Catholic Church, because the popes did not directly legislate that all must accept a distinction between animated and not animated fetuses, nor were those documents ex cathedra pronouncements that defined that certain fetuses lack human souls. Rather, the laws they promulgated in those bulls were meant to punish people who cooperated in abortion and related evils. However, in light of these facts and the arguments typically made for, quote, baptism of desire, every supporter of baptism of desire, if they are consistent at all, must believe that delayed ensoulment is certainly true and binding upon all. That's because most of the sources and arguments they bring forward in their attempt to prove their position, and others they don't even cite, as we are showing, can be cited teaching delayed ensoulment. Their arguments would also require them to hold that the ordinary and universal magisterium taught delayed ensoulment, because according to St. Alphonsus, delayed ensoulment was held universally during his time. It was presupposed in the Roman ritual, supported by a passage of the Catechism of Trent, and more. But almost none of the baptism of desire supporters profess that delayed ensoulment is necessarily binding and true, which exposes their profound inconsistency and that they don't actually understand the magisterium and the parameters of the Church's infallibility. Many of them will hedge and say, "I'm not sure about delayed ensoulment," but that's inconsistent. If they were consistent, they would have to hold that it's a settled matter, and therefore life does not begin at what is considered conception. But almost none of them take that position. They fall into gross inconsistency on this matter because they have a false understanding of when the magisterium is necessarily operative. Some might object that delayed ensoulment is not a matter that pertains to faith, and therefore the widespread support for it did not bear on the issue of when the Church's infallibility is operative. But that is false. The issue of when ensoulment occurs with respect to the body is certainly connected with the faith, and it would at least be a secondary object of infallibility. In divine revelation, God reveals things about the soul in connection to the body, that humans bring forth after their own kind, that God fashioned people in the womb, etc. Whether the union of man and woman produces an animal that becomes a human at some point in the womb, as delayed ensoulment holds, or a human from the beginning, as immediate ensoulment holds, is connected to faith. Indeed, as we already proved, views on delayed ensoulment directly impacted whether baptism was administered to certain people. Hence, it's connected to the faith and to the administration of the sacrament. Moreover, on March 4, 1679, the Holy Office under Pope Innocent XI condemned the following proposition, quote, "It seems probable that every fetus, as long as it is in the womb, lacks a rational soul and begins to have the same at the time that it is born, and consequently it will have to be said that no homicide is committed in any abortion," end quote. The Holy Office condemned the position which asserts that it's probable that a fetus does not have a human soul until birth. It did not address the matter further. However, this demonstrates that the Holy Office considered the time of ensoulment to be within its purview and connected to faith. It should also be noted that widespread belief in delayed ensoulment was not just based on Aristotle. It was also based on the reading of Exodus 21:22-23 in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The Greek rendering of that passage distinguishes between a child in the womb that is incompletely formed and a child that is fully formed. The passage, as it appears in the Septuagint, prescribes a more severe punishment for harm done to a child in the womb that was fully formed. However, that reading is rather different from the Hebrew version, and thus does not prove delayed ensoulment. Some might also ask, doesn't the dogma of the Immaculate Conception defined in 1854 by itself refute delayed ensoulment? The answer is that the word conception can refer to either one, active conception, that is when the embryo begins to exist, which is often called fertilization, or two, passive conception, that is when the soul is actually infused and united with the physical thing in the womb. Conception is usually used in the first sense, referring to active conception, when the embryo begins to exist, that is, fertilization. That's how we've generally used the term in this video, but in the dogmatic definition of the Immaculate Conception, the word conception is used simply in reference to the first moment of the existence of the soul, that is, to passive conception. Hence, that definition does not address, one way or the other, whether Our Lady's body existed before the creation and infusion of her soul. It simply defines that she was preserved from all stain of original sin from the first moment of her soul's existence. However, we believe that her body and soul began to exist simultaneously from the moment of fertilization or active conception. Those who believe in delayed ensoulment, in the case of Our Lady, would have to hold that her body was at some point an animal embryo or an animal fetus with an animal soul, and that it became a human body the moment the soul was infused. We do not believe that is correct. In consideration of how many people believed in delayed ensoulment in the Middle Ages and beyond, as we're showing, some might wonder, why isn't delayed ensoulment the teaching of the ordinary and universal magisterium? The answer is that while belief in delayed ensoulment was extremely widespread over the past 1,000 years, there were people in the early church who did not believe in it. A prominent example is Church Father St. Maximus the Confessor. He argued, we believe cogently, that if Jesus acquired a human soul at the moment of conception, that is, when his body began to exist, and he has a human nature just like every other person except for sin, then all humans receive a rational or human soul at the moment of active conception. The 1917 Code's position on baptizing monstra and ensoulment. Now, in regard to the matter of whether to baptize those monstra or severely deformed fetuses, the 1917 Code of Canon Law took a position that was different from the one taught by the Roman ritual, St. Alphonsus, etc. This was connected to a different view of the time of ensoulment. Canon 748 of the 1917 Code states, "Monsters and prodigies, that is, deformed and abnormal fetuses, always are to be baptized at least conditionally," end quote. Here the Code prescribes the opposite of the Roman ritual and St. Alphonsus on this matter. It states that these monstra are always to be baptized at least conditionally. As we saw, according to the Roman ritual promulgated by Paul V, followed by St. Alphonsus and many others, those monstra were not to be baptized at all if they resembled a beast. Voivod and Smith, pre-Vatican II commentators on the code, state the following about this change. Quote, "The canon 748 about the misformed fetus is likewise taken from that source, the Roman ritual. Here the code corrects the ritual, which distinguish between monstra that have a human form and those which do not have that form. It is generally admitted today that a woman can give birth to no other than a human being, however deformed that infant may be," end quote. This is an extremely important and revealing admission. According to Voivod and Smith, noted pre-Vatican II canonists, writing with an imprimatur, the Code of Canon Law corrected the official prescription of the Roman ritual on whether to baptize such monsters who resembled beasts. Note that this is not merely a change in discipline. These are two opposing positions on a matter connected to faith, and whether to baptize a particular individual. The Roman ritual was promulgated by Paul V and approved by many other popes over a period of hundreds of years. We also saw that St. Alphonsus repeated that prescription in connection with his view that delayed ensoulment is certain. As we will see by the end of this video, this example by itself serves to prove our thesis and refutes the argument brought forward by Baptism of Desire supporters in regard to the 1917 Code of Canon Law. And I don't believe it's just a coincidence that this powerful example to prove our point relates to the issue of baptism. Now, one of the most prestigious commentaries on the 1917 Code is a 7-volume work called Jus Canonicum, published by Father Peter Vidal. It includes the work of noted canonist Father Wernz, and it's attributed to both. They both held positions at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. Here's what their official commentary on the Code, published by Vidal in 1934, states about this matter of baptizing monstra and the issue of delayed ensoulment. Quote, "All prematurely born fetuses at whatever time they were delivered are to be baptized, unconditionally if unquestionably found to be alive, and two, conditionally in a case of doubt," Canon 747. The effective reason for this prescription is found in the position commonly accepted today and, leaving aside the different opinions of the doctors of old, required to be held, tenenda, that the human fetus is informed by a rational soul from the first moment of its conception. Monsters and prodigies are always to be baptized, at least conditionally, Canon 748, end quote. The Wernz-Vidal commentary accepts the Code's position and contradicts the Roman ritual, St. Alphonsus, etc. It states that all such deformed fetuses are to be baptized at least conditionally. It also explains that this new prescription of the Code is based on the position commonly accepted by that time, that the human fetus is informed by a rational soul from the first moment of conception. It states that the different opinions of the doctors of old, that is, on delayed ensoulment, are left aside or abandoned, relictis, and the position of immediate ensoulment is to be held, tenenda. Just so people understand what this means, this prestigious pre-Vatican II commentary on the Code is essentially stating that St. Thomas, St. Robert Bellarmine, St. Alphonsus, the Roman Ritual, the Catechism of Trent, various popes of the period, and countless others were wrong about delayed ensoulment. We think that these commentators are correct in their analysis of this point, and that delayed ensoulment is wrong. But such a conclusion is absolutely impossible if you accept the faulty arguments and the false understanding of the magisterium put forward by proponents of, quote, baptism of desire in our day. According to them, it's impossible for the common position of theologians at a certain period of time, the Catechism of Trent and the Roman ritual, etc., to be wrong about something. They also hold that it's impossible for the Code to be wrong, so they have a big problem, because it's not possible for both the Code and the previous sources to be correct on this matter. They both cannot be correct about the time of ensoulment, a matter connected to faith, and about whether such monstra should be baptized. These facts prove that the arguments typically advanced as proof for baptism of desire are based on a faulty understanding of the magisterium, a failure to identify when a teaching is necessarily protected, and therefore the teaching of the Church, and when a teaching is not necessarily protected, and therefore not necessarily the teaching of the Church. Since immediate ensoulment is the effective reason behind Canon 747 and 748 of the 1917 Code, those who think that everything in the 1917 Code is necessarily spotless must hold that immediate ensoulment is binding, and therefore that the Catechism of Trent, St. Alphonsus, the Roman Ritual, the popes who approved it, etc., were wrong. In other words, they must hold that either the Catechism of Trent, the Roman Ritual, etc., were wrong about delayed ensoulment, or that the 1917 Code is wrong. Both cannot be correct. Before we mention a few facts about the promulgation of the Roman ritual by Pope Paul V, which is relevant to understanding the limits of the Church's infallibility, note that the Roman ritual affirms the Church's true teaching on the necessity of water baptism for salvation without exception based on John 3:5. We published a short video on this. The ritual states, quote, "It is holy baptism, the gateway to the Christian religion and eternal life, and which holds the first place among the other sacraments of the new law instituted by Christ, that the truth himself testifies to be necessary to all men for salvation," in those words, "unless a man is born again of water and the Holy Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God," end quote. That's the position we find in all of the Church's dogmatic pronouncements and the Church's professions of faith. The ritual was simply repeating John 3:5 and the teaching of Florence, Trent, and other dogmatic statements on this matter. Pope Paul V formally promulgated the Roman ritual in the bull Apostolicae Sedi of June 17, 1614. It was reissued for hundreds of years with the approval of other popes. In the bull of promulgation, Pope Paul V states, among other things, quote, "Our office obliges us to provide that a religious observance be given to those rites and ceremonies established by apostolic tradition and the decrees of the fathers." He refers to this ritual, selected as official by the authority of the same Church, mother and mistress of all. He says, "There remained to be published by the authority of the Holy See a volume of the ritual which would contain the genuine and sacred rites of the Catholic Church, those which must be observed by the shepherds of souls in the administration of the sacraments." He says, "As we see lying before us this well-arranged assortment of accepted and approved rites of the Catholic Church, we have judged that it deservedly should be published for the good of God's Church." End quote. As we can see, Pope Paul V formally and authoritatively approved this ritual for the Roman Rite. Now, are we saying that everything contained in the Roman ritual is therefore free from error or spotless? If you've followed the argumentation thus far, you would see that our answer is no. The answer is no because even though it was formally and authoritatively promulgated by a pope in a bull, and confirmed by many other popes, it was not promulgated as something that obliges every member of the Catholic Church. It was promulgated rather for one segment of the Church, the Roman Rite. When a pope is not teaching for all the members of the Church, or is not legislating for all the members of the Church, he's not necessarily protected. Hence, when defining papal infallibility, Vatican I taught that the pope is infallible when he defines something to be held by the universal Church, that is, by all the members of the Church. Likewise, Pius XII said, as we saw, that the Church is spotless in her sacred laws imposed upon all. Since the Roman ritual was not promulgated as binding upon all the members of the Church, but rather approved for a segment of the Church, it was possible for it to contain an inaccurate prescription about not baptizing certain monstra based on the view of delayed ensoulment, which commentators of the 1917 Code say was corrected by the Code. In this regard, this quote from Pope Benedict XIV's encyclical Ex Quo is relevant. Quote, "Since these errors have to be excised or somehow restrained, corrections and new additions more faithful to the original eventually are necessary. This has obviously occurred in the Western Church too, even though it is not as subject to these errors as the Eastern Church. Accordingly, the Roman pontiffs have often had to see to it that missals, rituals, breviaries, and martyrologies were newly issued in improved editions after appropriate corrections." End quote. But here's the key point. This principle, which explains why not everything in the Roman ritual was necessarily protected, also applies to the 1917 Code of Canon Law, because the 1917 Code was not promulgated as binding upon all the members of the Catholic Church. Canon 1 of the 1917 Code states, quote, "Although in the Code of Canon Law the discipline of the Oriental Church is frequently referenced, nevertheless this code applies only to the Latin Church and does not bind the Oriental, unless it treats of things that, from the nature itself of the thing, apply to the Oriental." End quote. Canon 1 proves that the code was not promulgated as binding upon all the members of the Catholic Church. Therefore, it's not guaranteed to be spotless. M. Leto Cicognani, 1934, quote, "The first canon rules that the code of canon law is concerned only with the Latin Church, that is, that part of the universal Church in whose sacred liturgy the use of the Latin language is prescribed, and at the same time it excludes the Oriental Church from the jurisdiction of the code," end quote. The commentators Voivat and Smith say, quote, "The first canon of the code states that its laws are obligatory for the Catholic Church of the Latin Rite exclusively, except in matters which, of their very nature, affect also the Oriental Church," end quote. Supporters of Baptism of Desire try to raise a counter-argument at this point. They point to the part of Canon 1 which states that the code does bind the Oriental Church if it treats of things that by their nature apply to them. They think that Baptism of Desire fits that category. That argument fails completely, however, because nature refers to a thing's principle of operation. Canon 1 states that if the code treats of something quae ex ipsa rei natura, that is, from the nature itself of the thing, that is, from its own principle of operation or force, that matter indeed applies to the Oriental Church. So, for example, when the code cites or repeats Vatican I or some other dogma that has a binding force from its own nature as a dogma, not from the code, that must not be dismissed by the Oriental Church but applies to it, because by its own nature or force it applies to the entire Church. The binding force or nature is from the doctrine or thing itself, not from the code. Hence, the Baptism of Desire advocate would have to show that Baptism of Desire has a binding force on the whole Church, not from the code, but from its own status or force as a dogma, or truth of faith, but they are unable to do so, and obviously they cannot cite the code in their attempt to do so, because that would be a circular argument. Equivocating on the term universal. With their response on that matter having been refuted, let's refute another argument they make in their failed attempt to prove that the 1917 Code was promulgated infallibly. They cite Pope Benedict XV's bull, Providentissima Mater Ecclesia, which promulgated the code. That bull, which Pope Benedict XV never signed, by the way, says that the code, as it has been arranged, will have the force of law for the universal Church. But their argument on this matter is refuted by the clause, quote, "as it has been arranged," end quote. As the code was arranged and promulgated, it didn't obligate the Oriental Church, as Canon 1 states, as we've shown. Thus, it did not bind all the members of the Church. So in the sight of the universal church, the code was promulgated as binding only upon the Latin church, and thus lacked infallibility. Further, people who make this argument typically admit that universal, used in reference to the code, refers to extension across territory, not to all persons. Well, laws that aren't promulgated as binding all persons in the church, even if they are universal in scope or territory, are not necessarily protected. We've already proven this point with the example of delayed ensoulment and the issue of baptizing certain monstra in the Roman ritual, an error corrected by the code. There are other examples from church history as well. Those Roman ritual prescriptions, authoritatively approved by Paul V and other popes, were universal in scope or territory. For example, a priest might apply them wherever he might be in the world, but they weren't promulgated as binding upon every member of the Catholic Church. When a pope is not teaching or legislating for every member of the Catholic Church, he's not necessarily protected because he's not using the fullness of his authority as pastor, teacher, and governor of all the members of Christ's Church. Therefore, if you define a law as universal because it's not limited in territory, but it still does not bind all the members of the church, then such a, quote, universal law is not necessarily protected. However, if you define a law as universal because it was promulgated as binding upon the entire church, all the members, then such a universal law is necessarily protected. This is not a debate about the meaning of universal, and various authors use the terms in different ways. The key issue is, are laws that are not promulgated for all the members of the church, but are promulgated as binding only upon certain members of the church, necessarily protected? The answer is no, as we've already proven with the example of the Roman ritual. By the way, in the bull that promulgated the Roman ritual, the term Catholic Church, which means universal church, was used repeatedly, even though the ritual was not promulgated as binding upon all the members of the church, similar to the 1917 code. This serves to refute the specious argumentation of a John 3:5 mocker and heretic named Mario, a very dishonest person who accepts the heresy that souls can be saved in false religions and lies about it, and promotes other serious errors. He also espouses heresy against the Immaculate Conception, among his other errors. He admits that universal in regard to the law of the 1917 code concerns territory, not all persons in the church. He then proceeds to attack a straw man by assuming without proving that a law that is universal in territory, even when it is not promulgated as binding upon all the members of the church, is necessarily infallible. But that is not the case, as we've proven. Indeed, the facts that we've already covered in this video, and those that we will cover, demolish the argument of John 3:5 mockers like him. They prove that they do not understand the church's teaching and when the infallibility of the church is necessarily engaged. By the way, that heretic, as well as the totally heretical non-Catholic group called the CMRI, misquote the Council of Trent. They use the blatantly false except through translation of Session 6, Chapter 4, which was refuted and debunked years ago. Another example of a law or prescription approved by a pope, which was not limited in scope or territory, and therefore was, quote, universal in that sense, but did not bind all the members of the church, were the harmful replies of Pope Honorius to Sergius. They were not ex-cathedra statements, but official replies to a formal consultation, as the Catholic Encyclopedia points out. In Pope Honorius's responses to Sergius, he forbids him from using the true expression two operations. He says, among other things, "We have resolved through the present letter to make these matters plain to your all-holy brotherhood. Excluding, therefore, the stumbling block of the new invention, we must not define or proclaim one or two activities." Honorius does not limit his instructions or requirements only to certain areas of the world. Hence, his replies were universal in scope, but not universal in terms of having been promulgated as binding upon all the members of the church. Hence, he was not necessarily protected from issuing a bad law or approving false teaching. In fact, Honorius was condemned for those replies. The Decretals of Gregory IX. The Decretals of Pope Gregory IX, promulgated in 1234 by the bull Rex Pacificus, are also relevant to this matter. The Decretals of Gregory IX are considered by many to be the most important and official compilation of canon law in the Middle Ages. Many authors describe the collection as universal, even though the bull promulgating them was only addressed to the teachers and scholars of the University of Bologna. Even though this collection was authoritatively promulgated to the teachers and scholars of the University of Bologna for use in trials and schools, it contains some errors. For example, in Book 3, Title 42, Chapter 3 of the Decretals, a document of Pope Innocent III, dated to the year 1201, is cited. That document teaches that original sin was remitted by the mystery of circumcision, but that is demonstrably wrong. It was contradicted by the councils of Florence and Trent. Florence declared that the sacraments of the old law, such as circumcision, did not confer grace, and Trent declared that not even the Jews, by the very letter of the law of Moses, were able to be freed from original sin. St. Robert Bellarmine, On this matter, the following quote from St. Robert Bellarmine on the Roman Pontiff, Book 4, Chapter 14 is relevant. Referring to an error of Pope Celestine III on marriage, he stated, quote, "But as for what Alphonsus says, that is, that Celestine's letter was at one time among the decretal letters, that indeed is true, but it cannot be thence concluded that a plainly apostolic and ex-cathedra decree was made by Celestine, since it is well known that there are many other things in the decretal letters which do not make any matter de fide, but merely declare to us the pontiff's opinions on that matter." End quote. Some people have claimed that this statement of Bellarmine does not refer to the official decretals of Gregory IX, but rather to unofficial collections. Although it's true that the particular error of Pope Celestine III on marriage was not included in the decretals of Gregory IX, Bellarmine's statement here that many things in decretal letters are not de fide but just opinions was not limited to particular collections. He was teaching that a decretal letter could contain an error. Various decretal letters do contain infallible and definitive teachings, but some do not. It depends upon the language used, to whom it was addressed, etc. This applies to the decretals of Gregory IX as well. Gregory IX's official collection contains many definitive teachings of popes and councils, but not everything in it is necessarily protected, since not everything in it was promulgated as binding upon all the members of the church, as we've shown. The same principle applies to the 1917 code. By the way, two of the most important decretals in the early church, which were typically featured in the most important collections of the earliest papal decretals, were Pope St. Siricius's decree to Himerius and Pope St. Leo the Great's letter 16. Both decrees contradict the idea of baptism of desire and any salvation for unbaptized catechumens without water baptism. See our videos and articles on those popes. Those decrees reflect the authoritative teaching of the Catholic Church on the necessity of baptism, to which all the members of the Catholic Church are bound. St. Robert Bellarmine also repeatedly taught that a pope could issue commands that are harmful. See Book 4, Chapter 15 on the Roman Pontiff. Also in Book 2, Chapter 29 on the Roman Pontiff, he states, quote, "Therefore, just as it would be lawful to resist a pontiff who attacks the body, so it is lawful to resist him who attacks souls or disturbs a state, and much more if he were trying to destroy the church. It is lawful, I say, to resist him by not doing what he commands and by impeding the execution of his will," end quote. So here St. Robert Bellarmine states that a pope could command things that he thinks must be resisted. A pope could not issue a bad law or command that is binding upon the entire church, but a law or command that a pope gives for certain people in the church is not necessarily protected. But even when a pope gives a command or issues a law in a manner that is not infallible, it should still be obeyed unless something of greater weight contradicts it. St. Francis de Sales likewise teaches that a pope cannot err when he speaks ex cathedra or makes a decree for the guidance of the whole church. Quote, "But he cannot err when he is in cathedra, that is, when he intends to make an instruction and decree for the guidance of the whole church," end quote. Notice the reference to the whole church. However, if a pope approves something for a certain segment of the church or for certain people in the church, he is not necessarily protected. The 1917 Code's problems. Before we look at where the 1917 Code is not spotless, which again was possible because it was not promulgated as binding upon all in the church, I want to emphasize something. There's almost no group on earth, and that includes the various so-called traditionalist groups that claim to have priests, which simply takes the 1917 Code and accepts it without qualification. That's because the 1917 Code of Canon Law forbids those groups from ordaining priests, consecrating bishops, offering masses, hearing confessions, etc. According to the letter of the 1917 Code, their entire ministry is illicit. As a result, those groups simply do not follow those laws of the 1917 Code. Rather, they look at the 1917 Code and they say, well, I don't think this canon applies to me, and I don't think that this canon applies to my situation for this reason, etc. They attempt to apply Catholic principles to determine which parts of the code are applicable and binding in our day and which parts are not. Their behavior is more evidence that the code was not promulgated as something that Catholics simply receive, believe, and profess without qualification. That was not its purpose. It was a collection of disciplines with some references to matters of faith for a certain segment of the church. If one may apply Catholic principles to the code to determine which parts don't need to be followed in our day, then likewise one may apply Catholic principles to identify which parts are not to be followed because they contradict a divine law or something of greater weight. At the beginning of the code, we find the profession of faith the Church promulgated in connection with the Councils of Trent and Vatican I. This infallible profession, which is binding upon all the members of the Church, declares that the sacraments of the new law are necessary for salvation, although all are not necessary for each individual. That's what every Catholic must profess, and it proves that at least one sacrament, namely baptism, is required for salvation. The profession does not state that the sacraments or the desire for them are necessary for salvation, which it could have taught if that were the true position, but it did not because that's not the true position. The fact that at least one sacrament is necessary for salvation is what we find in all the church's professions on this matter, which are binding upon the entire church. If baptism of desire were true, it would be found in the church's universal professions of faith, but it's not found in any of them or in any infallible statement. There are many other dogmatic arguments that refute baptism of desire, as our material covers. We will not repeat all of those arguments in this video. The church teaches that John 3:5 is true without exception. See our playlist of videos on the salvation and baptism issues for abundant evidence. The code also contains laws that contradict the idea of baptism of desire. For instance, the code says that the unbaptized cannot gain an indulgence, canon 925, that the unbaptized are not bound to ecclesiastical laws, canon 12, and that baptism makes one a member of the church, canon 87. According to those canons, the unbaptized are not in the church or subject to the church. That contradicts the idea of baptism of desire because those who are not in the church and subject to the church cannot be saved. That's dogmatically certain, see the bull, Unam Sanctum of Boniface VIII, among other things. Canon 6 of the code says that disciplinary laws retain their force if the law is of divine law. That applies to the church's traditional teaching that excludes the unbaptized from ecclesiastical communion and church burial. Canon 1323 of the code ensures the proper magisterial principles. It repeats that Catholics must believe what is proclaimed by the church's magisterium. Well, the magisterium teaches that John 3:5 is true without exception and that there is no salvation without baptism and the Catholic faith. The same canon also says that something must not be understood as dogmatically defined or declared unless this is manifestly established. Many supporters of baptism of desire and John 3:5 mockers violate that canon by falsely claiming that it's heresy to deny baptism of desire. Baptism of desire is not manifestly established as dogmatically defined. In fact, it's demonstrably false. That being said, the code does contain a few errors and novelties, which again was possible because it was not promulgated as binding upon all. In Canon 1239, after repeating the traditional law of the church that those who die without baptism are not to be given ecclesiastical burial, the code inserts a novelty. It says that catechumens who die without baptism through no fault of their own are to be reckoned as baptized. That is a novelty and an error. First, how would a priest determine and judge that a catechumen died without baptism through no fault of his own, and on that basis reckon that person as inside the church? Second, the church's traditional law, which is binding upon all, excludes unbaptized catechumens from church burial because they weren't inside the church or part of the faithful during life. See our video on the Council of Braga, which was approved by Pope St. Gregory VII. The Church's universally binding and traditional law on this matter, which was approved by popes such as Leo the Great, St. Gregory VII, Innocent III, Gregory IX, etc., is that Catholics cannot communicate after death with those who were not in the Church's communion during life. This law is definitive and outweighs the code's novelty. As Pope St. Gregory VII expressed it, quote, "We cannot differ from the relevant sentence of the Holy Fathers, namely, with those with whom we have not communicated while they were living, we do not venture to communicate with while they are dead," end quote. This law was also included in the Decretals of Gregory IX, Book 3, Title 28, Chapter 12. This is what all Catholics are bound to in this regard. Catholics are not permitted to insert into Catholic communion individuals such as the unbaptized, who are not in Catholic communion during life. And as we saw, even the code's own canons make it clear that unbaptized catechumens and the unbaptized in general are not in the church's communion. That's why the unbaptized are not bound to ecclesiastical law, not subject to the church, etc. In fact, the commentator Cicognani admits that by divine law, the unbaptized, including unbaptized catechumens, are not subject to the church's laws. The same is taught by many others. On this point, the Council of Trent infallibly declared that the church exercises no judgment or jurisdiction over those who are not baptized. Ergo, it's contrary to the divine law to tell priests to treat unbaptized persons as if they are and were under the church's jurisdiction and give them church burial when, by divine law, they could not be under the church's jurisdiction. So this is an erroneous law and a novelty that reflects the errors on salvation and baptism that were present in many fallible sources before Vatican II. It should not be a surprise that there were errors in fallible sources and documents in the years leading up to Vatican II. Vatican II did not happen overnight. And those who think that everything was super strong in all the fallible sources and theologians right up to Vatican II and then it all went haywire are totally naive and they have no clue about what's going on. The other error in this regard in the code is Canon 737. This actually isn't even a law or a prescription of the code. It's simply an erroneous statement. It says that baptism actually, or at least in desire, is necessary for all for salvation. But that's a novelty. The church's infallibly promulgated professions, such as Canon 5 at Trent, declare that the sacrament is necessary for salvation. They don't say, at least in desire. But that was changed in this novel and erroneous statement in the code, which, as we've shown, was not infallible. Does that mean that the code was a notoriously heretical document? No. In an analogous way, Pope Leo XIII and Pius X approved the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas for use after the definition of the Immaculate Conception, even though the Summa contains what is now clear heresy against the Immaculate Conception. Indeed, Pope Pius X formally mandated the use of the Summa in higher schools of Italy without removing the now heretical teaching against the Immaculate Conception that's in the Summa. Does that mean that Pius X required the use of a notoriously heretical book? No, he required the use of a book that is good overall, but not perfect in every way. A similar principle applies to the code. The reason that this error in the code on baptism is not notoriously heretical, even though it is contrary to definitive Catholic teaching, is that there were Catholic saints and theologians who wrongly believed that unbaptized catechumens could be saved. The code has a few other errors as well. It contradicts itself on heretics. For instance, Canon 1325 of the Code defines a heretic as one who pertinaciously denies or doubts a Catholic truth. So according to the definition of the Code, a heretic is of bad faith. A heretic is someone who is pertinacious. Yet Canon 731, reflecting the growing liberalism of the time, refers to heretics and schismatics who could be in good faith. But that's a contradiction. Someone who is pertinacious against the faith by definition of the Code, Canon 1325, cannot be in good faith, Canon 731. It's contradictory to refer to a heretic in good faith in a document that precisely defines a heretic as someone who is pertinacious or of bad faith. If someone holds a position that is contrary to Catholic teaching in good faith, that person is actually not a heretic. That person is a Catholic erring in good faith. Moreover, it's false to refer to someone who, according to the code's own words, needs reconciliation with the church and is therefore outside the church, as being in good faith. If someone is a heretic who needs reconciliation with the church, then that person by definition is in bad faith, not good faith. Hence, this is an imprecision and an error in the code, which again, was not infallible except in those parts in which it repeated infallible Catholic truth. Just as pre-Vatican II commentators on the code pointed out an error in the Roman ritual, Catholics can point out some errors in the code. The code also had a liberal law on passive attendance at non-Catholic funerals, services, and weddings, which opens the door to things that are not consistent with Catholic teaching and tradition. But that's a separate discussion. The fact is that there were many liberal canonists and theologians at the time the code was produced. In almost all cases, the code does reflect Catholic principles and traditional laws. However, in the few instances in which it contradicts something of greater weight, we must go with the more definitive teaching. That applies to the novelties and false canons on baptism in the code. In this video, we have thoroughly and in detail confronted and refuted the, quote, best argument Baptism of Desire supporters make for their position. We've shown that it doesn't prove their position, but actually exposes their false understanding of the magisterium and the church's infallibility. On the other hand, there are many dogmatic arguments which prove our position on baptism, which they cannot even begin to refute. We can also prove our position from the admissions theologians make about various principles, such as subjection to the church, church membership, the church being one in faith and sacraments, etc. But the dispute about the necessity of baptism can actually be solved very simply by answering the question, what does the Catholic Church require all of its members to profess about baptism's necessity? The answer is that the church's professions require all Catholics to believe and profess only one baptism of water that regenerates all the baptized, that John 3:5 is true without exception, that only the baptized are in the church, that the sacrament is necessary, that the church is a union of sacraments, that all in heaven in the New Testament period received baptism, and that it's unlawful to profess anything other than the one Lord, one faith, and one baptism of divine revelation. All of that contradicts Baptism of Desire, and the church has never required Catholics to profess belief in Baptism of Desire, or that anyone can be saved without the sacrament of baptism.